There are over 1 million identified species of insects and spiders in the world today, and that doesn't even include those that haven't yet been discovered or categorized. While we don't have quite that many here in Wisconsin, we certainly have enough to make sure we always have plenty to talk about when Phil Pelletieri comes by. Hi, I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller today. Phil is an entomologist and head of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. Phil, always great to have you back.
Nice to be here.
Well, we're getting to that time of year where biting insects are one of the less attractive parts of warmer weather and being outdoors. How many insects do we have in general in Wisconsin that are prone to biting humans?
Let's see. We have 54 kinds of mosquitoes.
At 54
least,
kinds?
Right. At least 10 kinds of ticks. Black flies, boy, I'm guessing that there's probably about 40 species or so. Only about 6 or 7 of those are really happy to feed on people. Most of those are bird species. Then we've got no-see-ums, and it's a long list, unfortunately, but that's kind of any place you go in the world.
Sure.
There's a lot of things that make their living out of eating people's blood, and that's what's usually going on is most of these things are utilizing the blood to make eggs.
And obviously some are just an annoyance, but some can be a little more serious.
Yeah, mosquitoes are always put on the top of the list because of the transmission of encephalitis, malaria, yellow fever, a number of things that come on. You know, the tick issues, Lyme disease, anaplasmosis and whatnot, and that's been a relatively recent occurrence in this state. Last year we had hemorrhagic disease associated with the no-see-um gnats in deer, and that's a phenomenon that you only see once every eight to ten years. But it's interesting. I think sometimes people forget there's lots of nasty things going on in the tropics, but we do have issues we have to deal with here.
Well, and with climate change and warmer temperatures going further and further north, some of those habitats are going to be moving north too.
And this has been a discussion that as things warm up, that some of those tropical things will become more prone. There's a little evidence we're starting to see a little Rocky Mountain spotted fever in the state, at least a little blip compared to what we historically have seen. You know, down the road, things like yellow fever and whatnot, which were honestly in Pennsylvania and the like, if you go historically. It's something that people's eyebrows are raised. When and if it will happen, I think, are still somewhat questionable. But the warmer it gets, the bigger the doors open for some of these things.
Well, in milder winters, too. I mean, it seems like ticks were active much later than usual, and there were still tick sightings in what we would think of as pretty much the middle of winter.
Yeah, well, I think that the deer tick in particular, the dynamic, since that's really only been a factor in the state for about 30 years, if there's no snow on the ground, it's above 40 degrees, they're active. And that's a big change for those of us who grew up here and, you know, back in the day when I was a kid, you worried about wood ticks for May and June, and then you're out of the tick season. So, as I said, because it's a different species, it has different activity patterns, you basically have to keep your guard up anytime you're walking in the woods when there's no snow.
And where are ticks? Are all ticks in the same kind of habitat? Or
Interesting enough, I mean, what we call the wood tick, which is officially called the American dog tick, you can find anywhere. I mean, people in downtown Madison are walking by the railroad right away, and they can pick up the ticks. The deer tick seems to be more restricted, usually wooded areas with quite a bit of understory. So you have to be out in the woods, per se. We rarely see that show up as an urban issue. So the niche it fills is quite a bit smaller. But if you get in the right place, they can be really quite dense.
And as far as carrying disease, are both dog ticks and deer ticks problematic?
No, for us, the dog tick is a non-issue. We don't see, as I said, the cases of Rocky Mountain spotted fever average like 1 every 6-7 years type of thing. The deer tick spreads at least 4 diseases, babesiosis, anaplasmosis, Lyme disease, and ehrlichiosis. And now there's even a Phocian virus that we're associating with it. And so that it's 5 things that you could potentially pick up. And at least 3 of those have been on a moderate increase for the last 10 years.
Going back to the no-see-ums, that's not exactly a scientific term, I don't think. No, what are no-see-ums?
So it's a little biting gnat we call ceratopogonids. And it's one of those cases the name is a little deceptive because when people have the sensation of being bit and they don't see them, they call them no-see-ums. You can see no-see-ums. Sandflies are another name that are commonly given to them. And although you typically don't feel the bite, often you get a nasty reaction because of the salivary components. And so this is one where people go down to Florida, they're walking the beach, they talk about sand fleas, which entomologically don't exist, at least not in the United States. They get these bites, you don't notice them at the time, you get on the plane, you come back home, and all of a sudden you've got these weeping wounds that take 2-3 weeks to settle down and itch. And,
wow.
And so it's not a pleasant experience, but the association is such. Now, those critters cannot be found indoors. It's exclusively outdoors. Very weak flyers. You typically find them at the edges of marshes and ponds because they're breeding in that interface of mucky ground. And so you get bit at dawn and dusk. You know, if the wind's blowing, it's not a problem. And so it's kind of a hot and cold thing. And historically, we don't have the problems with no-see-ums like they do in tropical areas. So it's normally more of a tropical pest. But if you're in the wrong place at the wrong time in Wisconsin, you can experience them.
And it doesn't sound like an experience anyone would want to have.
No, as I said, this 2 or 3 weeks worth of itching is something that people remember for quite some time.
Well, of course, mosquitoes are the most common, I think, that we run into, even just walking out the door or walking from the car to the house, let alone if you're spending a lot of time outdoors. Now, last year with the drought, it seemed like at least the mosquito population was really down.
Yeah, the way I try to explain it to people, it is not normal in this state to go out at dusk and have a picnic or grill or whatnot and not get chased in the house. But when you get a drought period like this, it's the exact opposite. It's incredibly pleasant to go out at any time and not be bothered with mosquitoes. This year, it's quite easy to predict with the amount of flooding rains that we've had, the amount of standing water, that it's starting. The trickle has started within the next week to 10 days. Everybody's going to experience what I would consider average mosquitoes, but after a dry year like last year, people are going to be unusually upset,
right?
And claim how bad they really are. But as I said, this is the norm, and it usually happens Memorial Day a few days early if it's a warm spring, a few days late if it's a cold spring. And as I said, it's if you haven't experienced it, it's going to happen relatively soon.
So brace yourselves.
Yes.
Well, we are talking with Phil Pelletieri, entomologist and director of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller, and hoping that you'll join the conversation by calling 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@WPR.org, or feel free to post a question, comment, or an insect photo on the Facebook page. That's The Larry Mueller Show, and Mueller is spelled M-E-I-L-L-E-R. And there are a couple photos up there that we'll talk about in a bit. But since we are talking about mosquitoes, let's go to Don in Winchester. Hi, Don.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Good. I appreciate the program. And this is my first spring and summer in Wisconsin, and everyone has been warning me about the mosquitoes and that they're going to be horrible and just wait. And so I'm wondering, what is the absolute best way to protect yourself against mosquitoes? What spray or what needs to be done in order to make sure that we don't get bitten alive?
Well, a lot of it is where you plan to do your outdoor activities. I mean, in general, sunny days with wind, they're not active. At dusk, when the wind speeds go down, the humidities go up, they become more active. The lusher the area you're in, the worse it gets. So as I said, you can be at a park one day in the middle of the day and you don't see them. You come back at the same place at dusk and you just get chased in. And one of our problems with our Wisconsin mosquitoes is many of them can come from 10 miles down the road. So it's not as if you have control of the breeding populations. Hmm. So cover up. You know, long sleeve shirts and those kind of things help. Hats sometimes help. The repellents do work. People sometimes are not comfortable with it. And to be honest, when the mosquitoes get ridiculous, if you have to go crawling in a swamp at dusk, I mean, you got to expect it to be bad. In the way that we evaluate how bad they are, honestly, is by somebody sacrificing their back, and we count the number of mosquito bites that people get in a period of time. This is the easiest way to get a good piece of data.
Is this one of your grad students you send out there?
No, well, it's hard to find graduate students. Graduate students are too smart to do this.
Undergrads.
It's a dedicated entomologist, I'll put it that way. But it turns out when you start experiencing about 5 bites in a 3-minute period of time, those are the kind of numbers that will drive you indoors. And when you get into these ridiculous situations, you can get 120 mosquitoes on you in a minute. I mean, but in those cases, the one thing I suggest to people who just love the outdoors and want to go out is, in many sporting goods stores, you can buy these mesh mosquito suits. They're very lightweight. They're very billowy. And you can put these on and go out and work in the garden or, you know, in my case, I like to shoot archery. And sometimes, like most archery clubs, we're in a swamp because it's the only land we could afford to buy. And so when it's really bad, I have one of these mesh suits and I still go out and shoot. But it has a hood that comes over the top, and And as I said, so...
Does it look kind of like a beekeeper's suit?
Yes.
Okay.
Very much so. And they even have pants. I don't usually wear with the pants because, you know, wearing long pants and socks usually will obstruct my legs. But I just keep this in the car. And as I said, and it works against other biting flies like horse flies and some of the black flies that may be an issue if you're next to a river. Now, the good news about this is normally if we don't stay in a very wet pattern, by the middle of the summer, things will get quite a bit better. So you can predict the mosquito pressure a lot by how much standing water is around. And, you know, it usually doesn't stay this wet all summer long. And so, but when it does, you get a push, and the push usually lasts about 4 or 5 weeks. And that's what I'm expecting to start now, again, because of a very wet spring that we've experienced.
What is the best spray to use, and where can I get a mosquito repellent outfit that you're talking about?
I would check it at a place like REI, L.L. Bean, if you want to mail order it, Gander Mountain, Dick's. I mean, it's usually camping stores that would sell it. Now, in the realm of mosquito repellents, DEET has been the old standard. It's been used since the 40s. There are some very good natural repellents, some soybean oil products, some citronella products. The difference between the products is really more how long they last when you apply them, and that depends on formulation and concentration and the like. Some of them only last 20 minutes. Some of the higher concentrations of DEETs last for 3 to 4 hours. So as I said, there was a real good article in Consumer Reports a couple years ago that evaluated mosquito repellents and it broke it down in their testing again, how long it holds up and the like. You know, some of the things you find, the folk tales, I guess I would put, about eating garlic and whatnot really don't stand up. There's some other interesting things that pop up. If you eat bananas, honestly, for whatever reason, you're somewhat more attractive to mosquitoes.
Really?
Yeah. But does that a reason if you don't eat bananas, mosquitoes won't bite you? No, it doesn't work that way. And individuals differ in their attractancy. It is true that some people attract mosquitoes more than others. It has to do with a whole bunch of skin chemistry issues. So that's always kind of fascinating. And you know, personally, as I said, I tend to use more of the physical controls than using a lot of repellents. But there are times when the repellents are a nice tool to use.
Thanks for that call, Don. And let's go to Nick in Green Bay for another mosquito topic. Hi, Nick.
Hi, I've got a quick question for you. My backyard is literally a swamp. Like, I'm not joking. We got a creek back there. In the middle of summer, you can't go back there because you said like 5 mosquitoes in so much time. That's nothing for ours. We get like 10, 15 mosquitoes on us when we go back there. The kids can't even play in the backyard. Any suggestions on how to relieve the mosquitoes?
Well, Phil, you were saying that they can travel pretty far, but Is there anything we can do to make our little micro habitat there less appealing?
Anything you can do to promote light and air movement. Because what happens, the moving water is not a breeding site for mosquitoes. But when mosquitoes are in the adult stage, when it's windy and sunny out, they literally rest in long vegetation where it's damp and cool and the like. And so mowing in some cases, sometimes cutting trees to get air movement. You know, people that are lucky enough to live up on a big hill with no vegetation around often get enough air movement even at dusk. They don't have any mosquitoes. If you're in a low area that tends to, again, restrict the wind and keeps the humidities up, it's just more favorable. So to some degree, whatever you can do to mow, get rid of excess vegetation, especially from the ground level up a couple feet, that will help to some degree. But it may just be an artifact that there's a limit to how much of that you can do. And again, unfortunately, you're in a case where a lot of mosquitoes will be real comfortable to hang out. And then once the conditions get right, it's much like I tease golfers, but you hit into the rough and all of a sudden you walk in that long grass and you see these clouds come up. They're literally resting down there, and that activity of you being in there, they know that potentially a meal's there, and they're up and looking.
It's like the dinner bell being rung.
Yes. Yeah.
Well, Shannon in Chicago has a suggestion for mosquito traps, so let's take one more mosquito question. Hi, Shannon.
Hi there. I'm actually a former student of Larry's, so it's a pleasure to be to be listening. I have about 7.5 acres of hardwood forest in Marionette County. And I was looking online at those mosquito traps, the ones that are made out of like a 2-liter bottle using like baking soda and brown sugar. And I'm thinking about bringing and doing that up there. But my husband joked, he said it's probably like putting a dehumidifier in a rainforest.
I'd be honest, I think your husband's right. Now, so the truth scientifically is the first thing that mosquitoes react to is carbon dioxide. And some of you might be familiar with those mosquito magnet and similar machines that have been sold where you put an LP tank on and it has a burner and it has a vacuum and it sucks these mosquitoes in. And you can catch a ton of mosquitoes. But even under those kinds of traps you find on high populations, you just don't catch enough to make a difference in that big a geographic area. And so the same thing with these traps. You will catch some mosquitoes, but in moderate populations, there's so many mosquitoes, and if I put you in the backyard in one of those traps, they will be far more attracted to you. And so, as I said, there is a partial truth to this, but expectations are such that it might make you feel good. You're getting revenge because you are catching mosquitoes, but it's not going to be the difference between allowing you to go out and not going out just because you put the traps out.
Okay, so like if we had them in the immediate area of the campfire pit, it really wouldn't make any difference. In fact,
when people ask me, the thing that really is probably as much productive is taking advantage of their mosquitoes being weak flyers. So, you know, it probably won't work here because it's kind of a campground situation, but on people's decks, to be honestly, setting fans to blow against the area you expect the mosquitoes to come to can make a big difference. Because, as I said, that's one weakness in their biology is anything above about a 10-mile-an-hour airspeed, they can't fly against. And so they can't get to you. Huh. And so that is a physical thing that does have some potential effect if you can utilize it.
Great. Well, I bet there's going to be a run on small portable fans because of that advice. We're talking with Phil Pelletieri. He is an entomologist and head of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson sitting in for Larry Mueller today. And you can join the conversation by calling 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Our on-air producer, Gabby Pedriani, will be happy to take your call. Talking about the fascinating world of insects with entomologist Phil Pelletieri and with you when you join the conversation. And Al in Land O'Lakes is up next. Hi, Al.
Hi. Good show.
Thanks.
My question is about the Lone Star tick, but first I have to say I've got two friends that almost died from Lyme's disease. I just was told about a woman I know that they, for years, thought she had MS. But it turned out to be Lyme's disease. It was never diagnosed. But I could talk to Phil for a long time about my insect problems. But I'm curious, how far north has the Lone Star tick come? How many diseases that can kill you does that have? And is there any place on Earth left where you can get away from ticks? And I'll hang up and listen to your response.
Great. Thanks for that call, Al.
First question, I'm not sure, but I think the deserts of Arizona would not be a place I would expect you'd be very likely to run into ticks. I mean, I think of them usually more in areas that have lots of rodent populations and the like. Now, Lone Star tick is still not officially considered breeding in the state. Interesting enough, I had a specimen come in the lab early part of this week that was found in the Madison area, and I've traditionally seen that. But things are changing a little bit. I think of that as a Central Illinois, a Missouri tick.
And I'm guessing from the name, it was maybe first found
Southeast,
in Texas.
Yes.
Okay.
Well, it has this one white spot on the back.
Oh, okay.
So that tends to get where the Lone Star comes from. But my colleague Susan Paskowitz, who is our medical entomologist in the department, has found evidence. In fact, we look back in my own old historical lab records of where we've seen Lone Star ticks. But what she found very interesting is some immatures, not adults, which is starting to suggest we might be getting a little bit of breeding. And, you know, one of my favorite lines to use on this show, and I use it a lot when I lecture, is the governor moved us to Missouri and didn't tell us. Because that's the dynamic in my career, is that a lot of southern things are etching upwards because of the lack of cold weather. Now, Lone Star tick, to be honest, is not to me as big a carrier of disease as Lyme disease or as the deer ticks, or what we officially call the black-legged tick. There is a Lyme-like disease that they do spread. Apparently, it might be another Borrelia. They're still kind of working that out. But when we look at Wisconsin, we have classic Lyme, anaplasmosis, at least one kind of ehrlichiosis, and these are all rodent diseases that the tick is the bridge. And for whatever reason, the black-legged or deer tick has got the right things, and these diseases continue to work through and are vectored by it, which means they are spread by it, whereas things like wood ticks are not. You always got to be a little careful on the internet, because I still have people claim that there has been scientific evidence that mosquitoes spread Lyme disease and like, and there just isn't. I am not familiar with any of those papers, and it has been looked at. It can't happen. In the same with what we call wood ticks or American dog tick. in the laboratory. We've not been able to get it to transmit these diseases.
And I have to say, if mosquitoes were transmitting it, it would seem like there would be a whole lot more incidents.
Right, definitely. Yeah. The interesting case on Lyme in the state is that the percentage of ticks carrying the disease continues to climb up, which is kind of something we've seen throughout the country. I mean, that is not that unusual, and it runs approximately 4 in 10, so about 40% right now, of the adult ticks and half that in the nymphal population. And that's one of the explanations why it's been going up in a number of cases. The other interesting artifact, though, and this will be a short blip, but drought is not good for deer ticks. And so we've already seen some evidence our populations have been knocked down because of last year, but they will rebound. It's a two-year life cycle, so it doesn't happen overnight, but it will rebound. So,
all right. And let's go to Lynette in Madison. Hi, Lynette.
Hi. My question is about black ants. They're taking over our front yard and big, like, anthills or mounds or something. And also getting in our foundation in the front of our house. So they dig through that and they end up in our basement. I thought a couple years ago I heard someone say you have to go down 3 feet into the ant housing, whatever, and then dump in the insecticide to kill the queen ant.
Right.
Is that the way to do it?
Well, yeah. I mean, the queen is the mother of all the ants you see, and so you can kill all the ants you want, but if you don't kill the queen, the colony will continue to exist. I'm suspecting these are field ants, by the way they're behaving. They make the big mounds. The colonies can last for 10 to 12 years, and so they're a little hard to wane out. But in order to be effective, what you need to do is somehow make some channels using a metal rod or something, so you can put 3 or 4 channels, hopefully at least 10 to 15 inches deep into the ground, mix up whatever insecticide you choose at the normal rates. I usually mix it in a bucket and I pour it down those channels so it's penetrating deep enough that I have a pretty good opportunity of killing the queen. Whereas if I just treat the surface, it won't penetrate more than an inch or two. And although the ants might stop being active for a period of time, you really haven't controlled the colony. So it's kind of a spot treatment. It's a little bit labor intensive, but it doesn't take any fancy equipment. It's just a bucket and a metal rod, I think. And as I said, I often disturb the nest first to try to get an idea where to make the channels, because you can see the tunnels that the ants have produced, and then treat it from there.
Now, Lynette was saying that they had gotten through the foundation. Are ants actually able to do that, or are they? I would think that they're finding cracks and exploiting them.
Right. And although the interesting thing about field ants is they don't seem to like to come indoors for people food. So when people tell me that they've got big black ants inside, it's more likely carpenter ants, which don't make these big mounds out in the yard, whereas the field ants make the big mounds, but they don't come indoors. They're not the easiest to tell apart. It has to do with looking at them under a microscope. I do it more by behavior. And so, as I said, now, if the field ants are right up next to the foundation and they're pushing some dirt and stuff in, that makes sense to me. But if you're seeing large numbers of black ants indoors running around, then I'm more inclined to think they're carpenter ants. And then the question is, where is the nest there? Is it in the structure somewhere, or is it out in the stump? And the ants are just coming in looking for food.
And do I remember that carpenter ants don't eat healthy wood?
Right.
They only eat decaying wood?
I've come to the conclusion long ago we shouldn't have called them carpenter ants.
Too late now.
but the problem is what people misread is that, in fact, again, I had a sample this morning from up in Lincoln County. There was a bad windowsill, and it was all channeled. It looked like Swiss cheese. The ants weren't even there anymore. They could have been there 20 years ago. Who knows? Classic place, a soft piece of wood they moved into. They didn't eat it. They just lived in there. Mm-hmm. But they made those channels. But if you don't understand that, you see the ants, the ant damage, you say they ruined the windowsill rather than realizing that the water softened it up, it aged. That's the habitat they look for. But by nature, they eat other insects. Mm-hmm. They eat protein, they eat sugar.
I think people often think of them in the same way they think of termites.
Right. And it's a universe apart. I mean, termites, wood is, although interesting enough, they do like wet wood. I mean, it's easier for them to work. But your old house is a restaurant for termites, whereas there's nothing in your house that the carpenter ants will eat. But they will nest in soft stuff. So if the roof goes bad, they move into it. The roofer comes in and said, there's ants ruined your roof. No, that's not true. The water ruined your roof, and then the ants moved in.
Thanks for that call. And Jay in Ellsworth said, I haven't seen any bees pollinating my plants yet. Should I be worried?
Well, it was interesting. I was at the University Arboretum with my grandson this weekend, and the lilacs were in full bloom. The crabs were in full bloom. And what caught my attention is, boy, I didn't see any bee activity. So it's been slow in coming. And, you know, in the state, we lost about 30% of our honeybees, which is pretty typical in a bad winter. It's been a little early to call the native bee thing. I mean, there's hundreds of species and the like. I think most of this has been an artifact of how cool it is. It's not been good bee weather. There's nothing on the radar screen to say that all the bees died, but it's not been a good spring for them. So that might be, I think, more than anything else what's going on.
Just the last couple of days here in my backyard in Madison, I've seen some of the really big bumblebees that you can see, you know, clear across the yard. Just a few of those, but that's about it for what I've seen too.
Yeah, as I said, what surprised me is some of the solitary bees that I would expect to be more active. You know, and you need a sunny day, and it's got to be 65 degrees. I mean, those kind of things to get the bees moving. But, it's interesting. It has been so different from last year. I mean, and things have been slow. Just like the plants are slow to kind of wake up, the insects, I think, have been slow to wake up.
And actually on Facebook, Sandy asked, she said, I'm interested in what steps are being taken, if any, to preserve the honeybees. You were talking a little bit about the wild bee population.
Well, you know, again, you got to be a little careful in what you read. There's so many factors going into why honeybees are not doing well. Probably one of the best places to get very good information that has science-based, there's a Dr. Marla Spivak, and she works up at the University of Minnesota as a bee breeder, among other things. And she has been breeding different varieties of bees that honestly are super hygienic, which means they're very clean. And one of the things that those bees do is they remove these parasitic mites that we've been having problems with, and these parasitic mites are things that are introducing virus diseases and other complications into the bees. We're trying to understand what's causing the bee problems, and is there a way that we can breed bees that are resistant to this or at least tolerant of it? And so that's really where the hope lies. In fact, many people have argued that one of the reasons the bees have been in trouble is that we've been breeding them for pollination and honey production, which is important, but ignoring some of these other factors that are. And as I said, with her research, she has shown she's coming up with some bee varieties that honestly are far more resistant to some of these problems that we're seeing. Collapse disorder, pesticides, diet. I mean, there's just a whole litany of things that are coming into it. Yes, monoculture. And, you know, the old stress of putting a honeybee on a tractor trailer and transporting it from Florida to California to pollinate almonds is a major stress in itself. And so we know that anything you can do to get the colony strong and healthier bees, they seem to do much better. And if the bees have been weakened and the like, then they get into real trouble.
So there are things definitely being worked on. Great. And we are talking with Phil Pelletieri. He's an entomologist, as you may have guessed, and head of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller. Happy to have you with us today. And let's move from bees to wasps and David in Stoddard. Hi, David.
Hi. How's it going?
What's your question?
We get ground wasps around here, ground bees. They just make a little burrow down in the side of a hill, and they come out of there, and you can't go near it. You go walking past the damn thing, they come flying out and try and get you. And so I was wondering what's the best way to remove them.
Okay, well, there's two things to sort through. When you see lots of individual holes that things are active in, those are either solitary bees and wasps, and they are not aggressive. If, on the other hand, you talk about bumblebees and ground nesting yellow jackets that start in the spring with the queen, but the colony gets bigger and bigger, they tend to be quite aggressive if the colony is threatened or they deem it's threatened. And so what I suggest for those kind of things, first of all, I find sprays are not effective. Dusts are. So it's the formulation. And what you have to do is mark the opening and dust it at an appropriate time. And that's how we control it if you need to. Now, you know, if it's 10 acres away from the house, you don't worry about it. Where I worry is when there's people traffic, because whether you have to mow lawns or you're out walking and the like, if there's a place where you can possibly mistakenly, you know, step into it and whatnot, that's where the threat comes to you. If it's an area you don't have to be active in, they're not going to take offense. But so more common in late summer, that's when the numbers will be up, they're the most aggressive. And that's, again, when you really have to identify what the opening is and then dust it with any appropriate garden dust. As I said, it's the formulation that works. What happens is when they crawl through the dust, that's what does them in.
All right. Thanks for that call, David. And, Phil, maybe that's a good point since David used the word wasp and bee kind of interchangeably there. They're not the same.
No.
Tell us the differences.
Well, I mean, a lot of it has to do with diet. Bees collect pollen, and they use that as a protein source to raise young. Wasps, although they will stop at flowers for nectar and pollen, they basically are usually predators on, depending on the wasp, spiders, caterpillars, aphids, leafhoppers, all kinds of creatures. Other than that, if you look at them very closely, and this is kind of one of those kind of generic things, bees are always fuzzy. And honestly, they often have branched hairs like a feather on a bird. Wasps generally have a few single dark spines and hairs, but are not fuzzy at all. Color is not a good way to tell them apart, because we have black wasps with yellow stripes that just look just like bees. And, you know, and so, as I said, that's the thing that I tend to look for is more if they appear somewhat fuzzy, they're probably bees. And most of our bees are solitary bees that don't live in colonies. The only bee species we have are the five or six species of bumblebees that are common and honeybees that live in colonies. Now, for wasps, both the Polistes wasp and the yellowjacket wasp either make these big paper wasps up in a tree somewhere, but there are species that nest in voids, and those are the late summer problem ones. Whereas when you see a lot of activity in the spring, and I've had a number of these calls, some of these spring solitary bees make a bunch of holes in your yard, buzz around like crazy for 2 weeks, and then they're gone. And they are very non-aggressive. In fact, some of them don't even have stingers. It just depends on the species. And so a lot of activity in the spring I'm not concerned about. A lot of activity in the late summer, that's when you have to be more concerned.
And is there anything different about their body shape? Do some have, like, kind of that jointed thorax?
Well, there are some species of wasp, the thread-waisted wasp, that have a very constricted area between the abdomen and the thorax, but not all. And so that part doesn't. They said it really gets down to looking for
fuzzy
the fuzz.
Or not. Yeah. Okay. Fuzzy bees, non-fuzzy wasps. Wasps. All right. Well, you mentioned aphids as something that I think the wasps are feeding on. Did you say?
Two things. When aphids secrete honeydew, that's sugar water, and some wasps utilize that. But we do have some small species of wasps that collect aphids. We've got small species of wasps that collect leafhoppers. I mean, lots of little things. So most wasps have a relatively restricted diet in what they will feed their young. And in many cases, there's a beneficial side to it. Again, if they're eating the caterpillars that are on your broccoli, that's good.
Right. So. Well, Mary in Madison must not have enough wasps around, because she's looking to get rid of some aphids, and she'd like to do it organically. Do you have any suggestions for Mary?
Insecticidal soap. I mean, there is a product called insecticidal soap, and it is considered organic, although it's not a natural product. I know we won't get into the politics of that, but I think most people are comfortable with soaps. Even a forceful stream of water is quite effective. And the other thing about aphids is, if you're a patient person, beneficials will show up. I mean, there's just a whole bunch of things that eat aphids. And it's fascinating, because most aphids will go through 8-10 generations a year in Wisconsin, but rarely do they have more than one or two good generations before something shows up and wipes them out. And so they will come under natural control if you're patient. It's just a question is, are they causing your plants enough misery that they're growing backwards or whatnot? And then you have to intervene. But as I said, soapy water. I'm much more comfortable with the products you buy at the garden store, because it doesn't have any perfumes or other things that might be phytotoxic. Plus, it will give you the right rates to use. It's always a little bit of a risky business to use some of the home detergents and the like, because people, again, there's often, I don't know what's in there.
You don't know what else is in there.
And again, the classic story, and this comes from this show years ago, killing box elder bugs. My colleague in Iowa State always said a half a cup of Tide laundry detergent to a gallon of water. And Larry and I were doing the show, and somebody had tried Cheer laundry detergent, was very disappointed. Well, the soap chemistries are different.
Right.
Whereas the insecticidal soap, we know what's in there. It's the right stuff. So.
Well, speaking of aphids also, Bridget posted a really great photo on the Facebook page. Again, that's the Larry Mueller Show, and Mueller is M-E-I-L-L-E-R. And she says, I raised some Luna moth larvae last year and discovered this one had a mite on it, but only when I went to take the close-up photo. And it's a wonderful close-up photo. But looking at that, Phil, you said that you think it's actually an aphid, not a mite.
Yeah, because the shape and the color, and I think I only see six legs, and it's very characteristic of some aphids that might be found on the plant. So I think that little critter was just hitchhiking. There are mites you can find on insects. They usually remind me more of ticks. They tend to be kind of dark colored and not quite as elongated. So, as I said, I just think that was a little aphid that was hitchhiking on the critter and doesn't pose the caterpillar any problems.
And it's a great photo if you go to see it. It's a big, plump, green
Oh, yeah, a trophy caterpillar.
Yeah, trophy caterpillar.
Luna moths are one of the hardest wild silkworms to chase down in this state, so that's
and
pretty neat.
The moths are beautiful. And then Carol posted a photo and said, my friend at work received this photo from her daughter. They think it's a nest of some sort, appeared overnight on their siding. I think it's that spray foam for sealing cracks. Can you identify this? And for those not in front of a computer, it's a very round, very yellow hanging mass. And Phil, you said you think it is?
I think it's a spider egg mass. And the reason, because the top part, the way it's attached, you can see is kind of a bunch of thread-like filaments.
Yeah.
And we do have spiders that lay eggs in this kind of egg mass. And so that's what I think is going on there is just in a few days, some baby spiders will be hatching out from there.
And Larry in Green Bay has a question about, I think, one of the more interesting insects. Larry? Welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for taking my call. I was up at a resort in Door County, and just after dark with the lights and there was a band playing, all of a sudden there's a praying mantis. And I thought it was – I've never seen anything like that around up in Door County or around here. I live in Green Bay. And every person that walked past went, oh, my gosh, you know, it was such a – a beautiful little bug. Actually, it wasn't that little. It was probably sure. About 2 inches tall.
So the story here is that there are two species of mantid you can run into the state. One is the European mantid, and the other one is the Chinese mantid. And historically, they could not survive our winters because the eggs would freeze out. That doesn't happen anymore. So we know we've got breeding populations in Door County, and I've got breeding populations in the southern third of the state. I was at a Brewers game with my son a couple years ago, and a mantid landed on the woman in front of me. And so a lot of us, again, who grew up in Wisconsin, I mean, they're not that hard to identify, but you just never saw them. But now it is going to become far more likely. And again, it's purely an artifact that it doesn't get cold enough anymore in the winter to kill the eggs off. And so we do have breeding populations.
And praying mantises do what? What do they feed on? Are they beneficial?
They are beneficial to a point. They are general predators. They will feed on a grasshopper, but they'll also feed on a honeybee. They prefer large food, and so they're not going to bother with mites or aphids on your garden plants. They're also territorial, so you can't build up their populations because they'll eat each other. And they also prefer bushes and hedges rather than, you know, kind of open areas to be. So they're a great creature, I think, to have. To observe, you know, kids just are enamored with them, and that part is fun. But when you look at their diet being a general predator for bigger things, there's somewhat a limit to how beneficial they are. They're definitely not a negative kind of insect, but mantids will not control all our pest problems is kind of a way to put it.
All right. We are talking with Phil Pelletieri, entomologist and director of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab, here on the Larry Mueller Show on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're happy to have entomologist Phil Pelletieri with us right up to 12:30 today, so I hope you'll stay tuned. And we have several people waiting to talk with you, Phil, so let's go right back to the phones. And Helen in Menominee Falls. Hi, Helen.
Good morning. I thank you for taking this call.
Sure.
I seem to have those little no-see-ums on houseplants that came from a floral shop in January, and I have put the glue trap down on just about at soil level, and I've caught a couple of hundred of them. Any suggestions on how to treat these or chemically treat them or how I can get rid of them short of destroying the plants?
What kind of plant is it?
There are peace plants, the peace lily, rubber plant. There's a fern, a Diffenbachia. All different plants.
Okay.
Yeah, they're not what I would call a no-see-um. I think you've got fungus gnats, which are very similar in appearance, but the big thing is fungus gnats don't bite, but they will breed in the organic matter of soil. They're not that uncommon as a greenhouse pest. I think a really reasonable way to deal with them is there is a special bacterial product that is sold at the garden stores. It is a form of Bacillus thuringiensis, the bacteria, but it's a special strain that kills fly larvae or maggots, and that's what you're dealing with here. If you go there and get one of the products, you just put it on the soil, you water like you normally do, the larvae feed on the bacteria, and they die. And so it's one of the less toxic ways of doing something. Some insecticides work. The problem I see with the insecticides is when people drench it on their plants, they often cause root problems. And so the plants grow backwards, which is worse than dealing with this nuisance of the gnats, as far as I'm concerned. So as I said, I would look at one of the bacterial products. Gnat Out is one of the commercial names. There's a number of other products that are out there. But go to, you know, a hardware store, probably not, but a bigger nursery or garden store. And again, look for a fungus gnat treatment. And as I said, it will be a bacteria. And that should take care of it.
All right. Thanks for that call, Helen. And let's go right to Dan in Oshkosh. Hi, Dan.
Hey, how are you guys today?
Doing well.
Hey, listen, I was wanting to ask if either one of you had ever heard about using virgin coconut oil as an insect repellent, because it works wonderful.
And what do you do with it? Do you rub it on? Or?
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. Yeah, you just rub it on. It pulls up on your skin. You don't have to worry about it staining your clothes. Mosquitoes will not land on you, period. They will not. And I've been using it now for the last couple of years. And I got a friend down south, and they've got these, the army ants, the, you know, you step in the ant mound and they attack you. I mean, he actually tried some virgin coconut oil on, you know, he rubbed it on his feet and on his ankles, up his legs. And he put his foot on the mound itself, and those ants would not attack him.
Huh. Phil, is that something you've heard of?
Well, and the one thing you have to factor in is with hundreds of different insects, you get hundreds of different reactions. And I do know ants, I mean, mint oil, there's a lot of things that they just are repelled by. But mosquitoes work in a very different manner in what they're attracted to. So I guess I'd go back to the comments of people have historically looked at all kinds of products for natural repellents, literally hundreds of different plant chemistries and the like. And, you know, catnip oil has got some repellency and the like, but there's a very few products that have been developed. And again, the ones that I know have been tested include soybean oil, which does have, you know, data to show it works, citronella oil, which smells lemony and the like. And my guess here is this has been looked at, and the question would be is how long does it last? And if it really was the answer, I think somebody would have commercially brought this forward. But as I said, I'll go back to the comment of if you're really looking for some science-based stuff, the Consumer Report piece, which originally I think was done in one of the medical journals, the pediatric journal, where they kind of went through all these studies and compared products and how long they last and those kind of things. And this was kind of a summary of that. And I don't remember coconut oil by itself, but as I said, there's also a eucalyptus oil that really has got a lot of use in Europe and has gotten a number of products marketed here with quite a bit of success. So I think people have a lot of options to look at. And I mean, it's fine to try the virgin oil, coconut oil, but as I said, in the back of my mind, I would think if this really was far better than other products, somebody would have taken commercial advantage of it by now.
I think also that coconut oil tends to be pretty expensive, so it might not be as cost-effective as some of the other suggestions. But thanks for that, Dan. We had not heard of that, and it's always good to hear about new and interesting approaches. Eric in Milwaukee has a question. I think he's hoping for an approach to get rid of a particular kind of bug. Hi, Eric.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. How are you?
Great. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I really appreciate the expertise here. I have two raised bed gardens in my backyard in a nice little small Milwaukee city lot. And I have been having a flea beetle problem where they attack my radish leaves and my kale and spinach, and I just can't seem to get rid of these little pests.
Am I remembering, Phil, that last year was particularly bad for flea beetles?
Yes, and this year I'm getting a little bit of a rumble. When you got good snow cover, most flea beetle species overwinter as adults, and so I always get nervous that if it's a lot of snow cover, good insulation, good survival. So they come out right away looking for plants. There are different species, have different preferences in the plants that they want. So the first problem is they're coming from off property, so you've got no control of that. So now it's a question of protecting the plants. That can be done with physical barriers like, you know, floating row covers. All that's a little hard to work with. As far as sprays, on the organic side, the spinosad product that's out there is quite effective for 4 or 5 days, and you may need to reapply it. And then with, you know, more conventional insecticides, 7 was a classic flea beetle product. So it's kind of when the first young plants start to come up and you see those first little holes that's when you have to draw the line. And as I said, if you want to go for an organic product, the spinosad has some pretty good performance, sold under Dr. Jack's Dead Bug Brew and Monterey's Fruit and Vegetable Spray, among other names. So it's something that's not that hard to chase down in a bigger garden store. Or as I said, there's a number of the more conventional products, but realizing that whatever you use gives you about 4 or 5 days of protection, so you may need to reapply.
All right. Thanks for that call, Eric. And another garden question. Jane in Amro said she had squash bugs all over her squash last year in her lasagna-style garden. Does that type of garden make for a more welcoming environment for the bugs, and how do I prevent them? And for those that don't know, lasagna gardening is basically building up compost above the ground. It's layers of brown and green organic material that basically form compost.
It was a good year for squash bugs. To be honest, I always thought we had one species. I saw four species last year, so that was just an artifact of the year. But I think they're here to stay. This is another insect that I always thought of squash bugs as being an Illinois insect, and now we're seeing them quite commonly here, and I, again, think that they're spending the winter much more successfully. One could argue, because they do overwinter as adults, that all that organic matter does provide them more shelter. But the benefits that you get out of that, I think, far outweigh this. I think the secret here is realizing that the first adult squash bugs will be moving on the plants as soon as you transplant them or the seeds come out. And that's when you want to slam the door, because you're stopping them before they lay eggs and the whole wave starts. So it's all about due diligence early, I think, to stop them. Now, there are some home traps that I've seen people use, knowing that indeed they're looking for shelter. I've seen people use small pieces of plywood or small shingles and put it in the garden on purpose in the fall. The squash bug adults crawl underneath it, and now we got them surrounded, so you can physically dispatch mm-hmm. them or the like.
And what do they look like?
The adults are brownish in color, a dark brown in color, kind of coffee colored, and depending on the species, will range between a half inch and 3/4 inch in size. So they're pretty big.
Mm-hmm.
When they lay their eggs, you can see the eggs on the plants. They are gold, usually laid in clusters, small spherical eggs, maybe 10, 12 in a cluster. And when they hatch into the nymphs, which are really the most damaging stage, they are kind of a greenish with a bit of a whitish cast to them. So it almost looks like a different insect. Like to feed on the undersides of the leaves. You'll often get wilting and other symptoms that the plant's under major distress. But again, you want to catch it before it gets to that point. So my piece of advice is, we know they spent the winter as adults. They're coming on the plants right away. There will be two generations if they've given the opportunity. But if you shut the door on the first one, that should help big time.
All right. And let's go back to the phones and Greg in Milwaukee. Hi, Greg.
Oh, hello. I was living up in Burnett County, and I was sitting out in the forest, and my dog got a black fly landed on his ear. And a metallic green wasp. I just want to know what it was. About an inch long. It just swooped down, grabbed the fly, and flew away. And I watched it for a while, and some more came back and did that. Every time a black fly would land on the dog, it would swoop down and grab it and fly away. And I was wondering what that was.
Hmm.
When I think of metallic green and wasp, I think of cuckoo wasps. But they generally wouldn't. I would have to see it. I'm a little bit, again, wasps by their nature are predators on plants. On insects, and that's what they get their diet. And we get things like bald-faced hornets that love to pick up great big flies to feed on. But the greens got me a little confused, because I've got a bunch of metallic green bees, too, but they would have no business doing that. So, unfortunately, I'm not so sure I can get my finger on it right away.
Well, Greg, maybe take your dog back out there, hope for some flies, and get a picture of that green insect. And actually, Tracy in Chippewa Falls has a question about another metallic insect. Hi, Tracy.
Hi, yes. I was wondering if your expert knew. I've seen a flying blue metallic bug. It's gotten in the house a couple times. It looks like a bee. It's got the same shape as a bee, but it's a little bigger.
Hmm.
Again, with the possibilities, I've got some metallic blue beetles. I've got some metallic blue wasps. I've got some metallic blue bees. And so, you know.
Metallic blue bees?
Oh, yes. You get the orchard mason bees and whatnot. They have a real nice blue metallic hue to them. So I'm counting wings and looking at those things to tell who's who there. So if you can give me a picture, I think I can give you a better idea. But there is a handful of possibilities.
Tracy, think you can get a picture the next time it pays a visit?
I will certainly try. Thank you very much.
Great. Thanks so much. And let's take a quick call before the news from Nancy in Grafton. Hi, Nancy.
Hi. When I was a little girl, I had to chase the cows through a swamp. I got stung by so doggone many mud hornets, and I took the mud and manure that was down in the swamp, and I put it all over myself. And you know what? I didn't have any problem with my stings. Is what the heck happened? Was it the mud or was it the manure?
So was it taking care of the stings you already had, or was it preventing further ones?
No, the ones that I got right there in that swamp.
What do you think, Phil?
What? I wonder if they would have trouble getting, depending how thick the mud was put on there or whatnot.
She was also saying it was helping take the sting out of the stings she got.
Well, you know, because they're putting anything in there that neutralizes some of the venom, you know, so sometimes that's pH related and the like, that could help a little bit. But I wonder if just physically protecting the skin might have made them less likely to go after you, or more difficult for them to get the stinger down to where they needed to.
Mm-hmm.
After I was stung.
Oh, you put it after.
Yeah.
Well, then, as I said, I think what happens is that maybe the pH of the mud and whatnot was such that it tended to neutralize some of the proteins that are associated with the venom, and that's why it hurt less.
Thanks for that call, Nancy, and glad you don't have to chase the cows through the swamp anymore. Well, we have Phil Pelletieri with us. We are not going to chase him through any swamps before 12:30. He's with us for the next half hour. We're going to take a quick look at the news from NPR and WPR, but we'll be back with Phil. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller, and you can join the conversation. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. Back in a moment. When you think of Wisconsin's wildlife, you probably think first of deer, wolves, coyotes, maybe bald eagles, sandhill cranes, and goldfinches. But in terms of both sheer numbers and number of species, they all pale in comparison to the insects that share our state with us. Hi, I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller today. Glad to have you with us on the Ideas Network. Entomologist Phil Pelletieri is our guide to the world of insects. He helps us figure out what we're dealing with and what to do. Phil, it's always a lot of fun to have you with us.
Nice to be here.
Well, we have lots more to talk about, and there was a question over email during the break from Kelly in Madison. She heard that there's supposed to be a record number of locusts this summer, and she wonders if that's true. Now, Phil, you were saying that locust is actually grasshopper, but in the popular press, it's really referring to those cicadas.
Yeah, the population out east of 17-year cicadas is just emerging now, and so it's getting a lot of press. We have a population of those in the state, but they will not come out again until 2024, and that's only in the southeast part of the state. So as I said, I would assume that. Now, locust, the classic grasshopper, is associated with droughts, but there is nothing, even with the drought that we had here, to suggest. It usually takes 2 or 3 years of very dry years to get populations building, so I've not seen any comments here. Now, out west, they have been dealing with droughts for, you know, better than a decade, and so their grasshopper populations are up, and to be expected with that weather. But as I said, I would assume that somebody here was mistaken for the 17-year cicada populations that are in New Jersey, Washington, D.C., and whatnot. And because of, again, that part of the country, they've been getting a lot of press for about the last 4 or 5 weeks.
Right, and it really is, as we were talking on the break, that growing up in Chicago, I experienced that at least once that I remember, and it's really incredible. I mean, you could not walk without stepping on the shelves.
I think it's well worth, if you're in a part of the country that doesn't experience this and it's happening within a, you know, a half a day's drive or whatnot, it's well worth going to. Now, again, we don't have a lot of activity in this state. There is a population in Iowa. Off the top of my head, I can't remember. It's in the next 4 or 5 years that they will emerge. I would suggest anybody go to the University of Michigan and do Michigan cicadas. They have a beautiful site of all the species in eastern North America, where they're found, when they're out, what their songs sound like and the like. And as I said, and they have quite a bit of stuff on the different broods, or what we call, people would call populations, but we call broods of the 17-year cicada.
Great. And let's go back to the phones and John in Milwaukee. Hi, John.
Hello.
Hi.
Oh, hi. I want to ask Phil about these. When I'm cutting the grass, intermittently I have to stop, and there's these little, like, moth-like creatures in the grass. I have to wait till they struggle out of the blades of grass and fly away before I can move on with my lawnmower. It looks like a moth. It's white and it's small. Is it a moth? Or
probably. I've seen big things like army worms and some of the cutworm moths, but I think what you're describing are what we would call sod webworms, and there are a number of species. In some cases, they even cause some lawn problems, but I tend to see a lot of cases where you see a lot of moths and no lawn problems, and that's the more typical. And that would be the habitat you'd expect them to be in. They're long and skinny because when they rest, they keep their wings, you know, folded very tight in like rather than out like some of the moth species are. But I would suspect it's one of the species, and the genus Crambus has a number of common ones that we see. But if you do a search on sod webworm, as I said, I think you'll see pictures of the adults.
Thanks.
All right. Thanks for that call, John. And you can join the conversation with a question or comment for entomologist Phil Pelletieri by calling 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org or post a question, comment, or insect photo on our Facebook page. And actually, Cornelia did just that. She posted a picture of a very fierce-looking black beetle with a pretty impressive set of pincers there, and she wonders what it is. She found it in her house last winter. What do you think, Phil?
So we call them ground beetles. The fancy name for the family is Carabidae. They're all predators, nighttime hunters. So they can't breed indoors, but they crawl under doors and the like. And this particular one, you can tell they're a predator because of those jaws, the way they're done. This one, they're very pronounced in this species and pretty big. I mean, that critter is about an inch long.
Wow.
And so it is impressive. Wouldn't bite you unless you handled it. And many of these are quite fast, and they have to be to search their prey. So nothing to worry about. If a bunch were getting in, I'd start to look at the door sweep or something that it maybe isn't fitting as tight as it should be because coming indoors is not the place they're mm-hmm. going to be happy. Normally, you find them under a rock or some other place during the day, and they come out at night to do their hunting.
All right. Great photo, Cornelia. Thanks for sharing that. Jackie in La Crosse emailed, "Every spring, my rose bushes are invaded by rose chafers. What's the best way to deal with these little guys?"
So I know she lives in a sandy area because we only see this is a native scarab beetle that's only found on sand. They look very similar to the Japanese beetle trap, but it is a rose chafer trap, and the difference is the attractant that they use. And there is evidence that you put a couple of these traps up, you can really make a difference. Now, we're not big on Japanese beetle traps. We
right.
know that they don't help, but the rose chafer traps do. There's a place called Great Lakes IPM out of Michigan that you can mail order these things, so you can get on the internet and chase them down. It'd be good to get after it pretty quick, because if I had to make a rough guess, about the 15th of June is when I expect the rose chafers to show up. So it'd sure be nice
about
to have the traps on hand. So I said, just do a rose chafer trap search. That would get you. But Great Lakes IPM is the place, and they've got an economy version and a fancier version. But you'll catch a bag full of critters, and those ones won't have the opportunity to get after your plants.
All right. Good luck with that, Jackie. And let's go back to the phone and Joe in Ladysmith. Hi, Joe.
Hello. I live in northern Wisconsin on sand, and every summer, shortly after the grapes have set their fruit, I get, I call them love bugs. I don't know, the females will land and eat the leaves. They just decimate the plant or raspberries or whatever, but they come in such numbers, and the male usually rides the female. And I'd like to know what I can do about it.
So are they kind of a light tannish in color, or are they more metallic?
Boy, right offhand, I can't tell you.
Okay. Well, I'm guessing it was the same critter as the previous caller, rose chafer, because you're on sand, and that does feed on those kinds of plants. The only reason I'm getting a little cautious here is Japanese beetle is continuing to spread, and I know I've got it in Barron County up by Cumberland. It feeds in a very similar manner. And the insects are related. They're both scarab beetles. It's just one's native, one's not. But, again, I would go on the internet and just do a rose chafer search, C-H-A-F-E-R is the way chafer is, and see if that's what the insect looks like. I think it's more likely. And as I said, because it's flying off your property, there's nothing you can do to kill the breeding population, but you can put these traps up and follow directions. You don't want to put the trap in the middle of the raspberry patch because then you're just drawing the critters in, but you can put it a distance away, draw them out, and they just fall into this bag and die. So there's not even any chemicals other than the attractant. The Japanese beetle works in a similar manner, but it feeds on a bigger variety of plants. Timing of a year is a little different. Rose chafer starts about middle of June, is done by the first week of July. Japanese beetle starts the first week of July and doesn't end until September. And so it's all summer long. And as I said, so if this has been a reoccurring problem for as long as you've been growing the raspberries, it's got to be rose chafer. And as I said, the way to go is with these bag traps.
And Phil, you've said in the past that the Asian beetles often are really bad for maybe 3 or 4 years, and then they kind of taper off.
Well, it's about a 10-year cycle.
10 years. I was being optimistic.
Yeah.
But are the rose chafers similar?
No,
they're just constant.
They're just there.
Okay.
And again, they're more restricted in their range because they need sandy soil. You don't find them on heavy soil. So even in a given county, you can have them in one corner, not the other. It's not that unusual. So anytime I hear sand and things that are feeding on raspberries, grapes, peonies, roses, I mean, that's classic rose chafer.
All right. And staying in the garden, we have an email from Kathleen. How do we get rid of slugs in the garden?
My best remedy is make your whole backyard a sandbox. I mean, it's environmentally related.
And perhaps another option?
Yes. So the thing about slugs is they feed at night and hide during the day. So the more mulch, the more vegetation, the more water, the happier they are, which is exactly what we do for our gardens. That's part of the problem. They do not respond to insecticides. They're a different animal. They're basically a snail without a home on its back. There are commercial slug baits that are sold. Some are iron phosphate based. Some of them are other chemicals involved. There are home remedies of using beer, and apparently the expensive high yeast beers are more attractive than the light beers.
Well, of course.
But the bottom
they're
line
Wisconsin
is...
They're Wisconsin slugs,
yes,
after all.
Yes. You can't get rid of them forever. It's when the conditions are right, especially wet years is when they do well. Then again, when you start to see damage on your plants, consider the commercial baits that you can buy, Slug Getta, Bug Getta, Sluggo. I mean, a lot of cute names. And that will help reduce the populations. Or as they said, or you can try the home remedies, but then they are quite labor intensive. And so you have to keep out refreshing the baits and those kind of things and the like. And as I said, hostas are notorious for both being fed on, but being the perfect environment for slugs because we keep them in the shade, we keep them watered, and we keep them mulched. And that's
and they create a lot of shade and keep them moisture.
That's what keeps the slugs happy.
Hmm. All right. Well, Travis is on the line from Owen. Let's go there. Hi, Travis.
Hi. Thanks for having me on the show.
Sure.
Well, my question is, about 10 years ago, I was in Washington State, and I was bitten by either one hobo spider 5 times or by 5 different hobo spiders. Having survived all that, it seems that since then, I am the magnet for spiders, and I'm just wondering, has it done something to my body chemistry that I attract spiders when nobody else does? Or do I just have really bad luck now?
Are you a superhero now?
I'm trying to. In my own mind, I believe I am.
Now, you know, the one thing I will say, and not to contradict your physician, but where the research has gone, so the hobo spider was the West Coast version of the brown recluse, where you would get this nasty ulcerated bite that would just not want to heal and but what the research has shown us recently is that a lot of what was diagnosed as spider bites was MRSA, were staph infections. And it's really unusual to get multiple bites. And in the hobo spider, what was really quite interesting, the original experiment, they took a spider and they crushed it against a rabbit and it developed this ulcer. So, okay. But now when we take the technique where we extract the venom of the spider and inject it in the rabbit, nothing happens. And when you take a step back, you wonder, did we infect that wound with secondary bacteria and the like? And so, as I said, I mean, there's no way to walk back and improve, but I would suggest if you want to get some good science-based information on spider bites in particular, Dr. Rick Vetter out in California. And if you just do Vetter and spiders, he has all kinds of information.
And
hobo
is it
spiders,
V-E-D-D?
T-T. V-E-T-T-E-R. Talks about this MRSA misdiagnosis and the like. Now, you wonder if indeed, again, because of that infection, your immune system is such. The bottom line is we find that most people, when they think they got a spider bite, it turns out not to be, even if it doesn't have that reaction. The only time I'm sure that it's a spider bite is shortly after the bite, if we can see the double fangs, which is characteristic of a spider bite, versus a single puncture, which would suggest some kind of insect reaction and the like. So as I said, when you come up with mysterious bites, more often than not, it is not spider related. But interesting enough, I mean, when you do get spider bites, it isn't unusual to get a nickel-sized reaction where it's quite bruised and sore and inflamed. But that often resolves in a matter of, 4 or 5 days. And anytime it's more complicated than that, you start to wonder if there's more going on than just that initial bite.
All right. Thanks for that call, Travis. And let's go next to Mark and Eagle. Hi, Mark.
Yeah, hi there. So the first few warm days this year, it became apparent that we had a fairly healthy wasp population in our house. And so I put out a couple of traps, and I've caught a few, but I understand if you catch the queen that it will, the whole population will move out. How do I know if I have a queen or not?
In the spring, they're all queens.
Oh.
I mean, that's how they spend the winter, is fertilize queens, and then they have to start everything from scratch, raise the young, and then those are the workers that help her for the rest of the summer. So it's pretty easy to say on those few first few warm days is it has to be queens. It's not been enough time for them to develop their young. So, yes, you are making the biggest impact now because each queen you're taking out is taking basically a nest out of the environment.
And is it important for Mark to figure out where they're nesting in the house? Are there clues for that?
Sometimes things are obvious. Some of these wasps, though, like void. So, you know, I tell people, if you had a history of wasp problems, and they're disappearing under your shutters right now, that should be a warning sign. And you want to treat that, again, because I don't know where the nest is, but I know where they're going. I would dust in there with any appropriate dust as a control method. And as I said, being proactive in the spring is far more productive than waiting to the end of the summer when now we've got hundreds of creatures associated with the nest, and it's a much more complicated and honestly more dangerous problem to deal with. So what you're doing, I'm a little surprised you've had as much success with the traps, because I tend to find the traps tend to work better for workers when they're scavenging than the queens. But if you're catching queens, keep doing it.
So they also seem to be going under my siding, like you say, in voids and in the shutters and that. I mean, I can't dust the entire house, and they don't seem to have a particular corner they like. Is there any, I mean, do I just have to wait and knock down their paper wasp?
But see, the thing about knocking it down, they just reconstruct it. And so if it's an area where you can't tolerate having it there, then I think it's better just to get after the queen and kill her. And as I said, you know, so dusting under the classic places in openings in the shutter. The one thing that would help and aid this is at some of the hardware stores, you buy something that's called a bulb duster, which is basically like a little bellows with a little straw, which aids in dusting into these void spaces. You don't need a lot of product. You just need to somehow blow it into. You could use an old squeezed mustard bottle or ketchup bottle in a similar manner to do it. So as I said, the areas that you've seen activity in previously, I would go to. It gets much more complicated if you have shake cedar roofing and whatnot, so you've got thousands of places to go. Then if it's been a long-standing problem, you might consider getting somebody to commercially spray something that's got some residual. They use microencapsulated insecticides to do it. But then the other argument, if you've got a two-story, they're up in the roof, that shouldn't be a bother. I mean, again, the big threat is when they're in a place where the nest is close enough to where people are active that you can bump into it. Or, again, I got zapped. We've got this new European paper wasp that's moving in the southern part of the state, and it's notorious for hiding its nests. And so, you know, we got this terracotta sundial at the house. Every year they're in there, you know, and you don't see it, but if you move the sundial, they'll let you know it's there. Or I was up pulling out leaves from my eaves, and I got stung, and I wonder why. Well, when I looked closely, the aluminum flashing had just enough of a seam, and they were up underneath there. So when I was pounding away, pulling stuff out, they took offense. And as I said, that's the main thing with this European species that's becoming more common, is that they're not out in the open. You don't know they're there, and that's where there's a higher likelihood of you getting stung.
Now, I'm wondering if that's what I might have, because we have an electrical outlet on the outside of the house, and there's a flap door on it. And when I lift it up, there's a little wasp nest in there.
They're so fast at doing it. I even found one in the swing door of my gas cap. And I opened it up, and there was a little pedestal and four little cells. So that queen had already started to build the nest in the week's period of time or less that I had. And that's, again, it's an interesting thing to watch, because it's a new creature here. Now, the other side of its biology, it's a very aggressive caterpillar feeder. And so we find that, again, the cabbage worms and a lot of the garden pests are hurt, but also some of our butterflies, because they're in the caterpillar stage. It's a very efficient predator at caterpillars. And again, there's some research out of Colorado State and whatnot talking about the general impact of another non-native species moving in. And aside from stinging people, it has some other interesting impacts.
You just mentioned butterflies, Phil. When do butterflies usually emerge? And is this colder, longer spring going to have an impact?
So I had talked to people at the Milwaukee Journal couple days ago, because it had caught their attention. Bad butterfly year last year, not a good butterfly spring this year. We didn't get any of the southern migrants we sometimes blow in. And I think we started with low populations to begin with. Now, they can rebound, but as I said, last year, if you're a butterfly person, although there were some neat southern visitors that came up here, it was not a good year. And this year, because of that, the spillover is we're not starting with high populations. And so the only butterfly I've seen is the imported cabbage worm, the critter that lays the eggs that make the green worms on your broccoli. So,
with just our luck, right?
Yes.
Talking with Phil Pelletieri, entomologist. And let's go next to Mike in Oshkosh. Hi, Mike.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
I tell you, my mind is all abuzz from all the new information I've gotten. I just have one question about fire ants.
Sure.
That are troubling me. My wife gets out in the garden where we have strawberries, in particular this year, and the strawberries have these mounds in there with the fire ants in them. They just tear her up when she tries to pick strawberries. Can you recommend something that might help with these fire ants and not affect the consumption of the strawberries?
Okay. So they're not fire ants. Fire ants are southern. This is the field ant. Instead of stinging, they're biting her, but it's still an unpleasant experience. And again, the disturbance of picking the berries is what's getting them excited. We had talked earlier, the problem with killing these is that the queen is down on the ground. We have to get to her. So this is what I had talked about, using something to help you make a channel or a tube down in the ground. So I just use, a long metal rod and push it down in the nest in three or four places. I mix my insecticide. And what you want here is something that is not systemic, so that the roots do not pick it up. But that's most garden insecticides are not systemic. So permethrin 7, you mix it up in the normal dilution rates in a bucket or a big plastic jug, and you pour it down those channels that you produce. So you're going to spot treat each one of these mounds, but you just do it once and you're done. And as I said, if you use something like 7 or permethrin, they are not systemic, so they really don't. In fact, those products are labeled for putting on the berries themselves, but there's no reason to do that. You want to get this down in the ground where it kills the queen, so it basically knocks the colony out.
Fantastic. I appreciate that. Just to correct a statement earlier, I apologize. I'm from South Carolina, and that's where I'm having the problem at.
Oh. Aha.
Well, then you might have fire ants.
One of the options that you've got there are special baits that are made for fire ants. Amdro has one and whatnot. And so it's the same concept. We're killing the queen and picking it up. But, then it makes more sense. Although it's interesting, I just read a recent article about a new invasive ant in Texas that honestly is kicking the fire ants out. It literally is out-competing them. Interesting, gardeners are finding that they're getting more pests because the fire ants do have a benefit of being predaceous on some of the problems we've got. But with any ant, the whole secret is you got to kill the queen. You got to find out where she is. And so that's the trick, whether you bait them or you treat them. And, these surface treatments that we use really don't solve the problem. You got to really get and kind of dig into it. And as I said, so I think for your case, the commercial baits might be a better way to go, easier to work with, I would say.
And that wouldn't pose any threat to the edibility of the strawberries?
No, in fact, baits in most cases are less toxic insecticides. We use less chemical involved, and they're more direct in what they do. So if you can find a bait that the ants take, boy, that's the way to do it. Unfortunately, like our field ants up here, we do not have a bait that's effective against those.
All right. Well, thanks for that call, Mike, and good luck with that. And Phil, we're out of time. It's amazing how quickly it goes. Phil Pelletieri is an entomologist and director of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. Always a lot of fun, Phil.
Nice.
And coming up tomorrow at 11, Dr. Kurt Slatke is here to answer your questions about keeping your exotic pets happy and healthy. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller. Stay tuned to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.